Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus in biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at BFL in Switzerland, and will be your host today. Today, we'll be talking to Elena Esposito about the new book, Artificial Communication, How Algorithms Produce Social Intelligence. Algorithms that work with deep learning and big data are getting so much better at doing so many things that makes us uncomfortable. In Artificial Communication, Elena Esposito argues that drawing this sort of analogy between algorithms and human intelligence is misleading. Esposito proposes that we think of smart machines not in terms of artificial intelligence, but in terms of artificial communication. Elena, welcome to the show.
Hi, Galina. Thanks a lot. I'm very happy to be here.
So how are you? How has your week been?
Well, you know, I'm in Bologna in Italy now, and spring is beginning, or almost summer. That's, of course, very nice, even if, like everywhere, you know, here in Europe, it's a hard time. It's a dark time. The war is here around the corner, so you cannot be really so serene without any negative thoughts.
Yeah, for sure. It's really difficult times now.
Yeah.
So can you tell us, what do you do?
Well, I'm a sociologist and I'm, well, my everyday life, I'm a university professor. And I have this sort of unusual situation that I'm half time in Italy, where I'm now in Bologna, and half time in Germany, because I have a double affiliation to two universities. And yeah.
So how did you get interested in sociology?
Oh, we are going back some decades. And I was a young student at university. And you say, I was really looking for something really exciting. And that's not the first theoretical exciting, challenging, difficult, complex, and really interesting and relevant also for our society. And that's not what you first associate with sociology being so exciting, but it was at the time I was in Bologna in the 80s, and it was a really interesting, vibrant time at this decade in Bologna, which actually now it becomes sort of a mythical decade. People remember it. It was really... there was so much going on, and it was sort of a crucial point for the industry developments in Italy. And I happened, my university professor, my first degree, I did it with Umberto Eco, who was a great teacher. At the time, it didn't become the sort of a world famous intellectual. He was already very famous, but on a different level. And he was a great teacher. And so I became interested in questions related to language and media and the way to deal with that. Also, the beginning of thought about computers that at the time. And that was the beginning of the interest in this topic. But then I moved from a more philosophical interest to a more sociological one, because I happened to meet the work and then of the person who became my PhD supervisor, which is not very well known in the English-speaking world, but it is extremely famous and highly reputed in Europe. And the name is Niklas Luhmann, who taught at the time in Germany. And so I moved from Bologna to Germany, and that's how it happened to me that developed the same topic, the same interest in media communication, social effect of these things from a more sociological perspective, more than a semiotical one or a philosophical one, which of course remain in my background, but it's not what I'm doing now.
And what excites you about working in academia?
What excites me is, mostly there are some things that I find so exciting, actually, but what I really find rewarding and still I love my job is, on one hand, you can develop always new topics. And you, for example, in my field in the humanities, you don't even need that very much founding or machines and so on. So we are always, you are challenged at the best level that you can do on the topics that you find most interesting. And that's really a big advantage, because it is a sort of a never-ending adventure, in a sense. That's one aspect. And the other one is, it's really nice to be in a continuously everyday contact with new, young generation and students who are clever, informed, updated, and that's also very rewarding.
And what would you say to our student listeners and also early career researchers?
Students and colleagues, of course, young people, and of course also the peers. No? Also, that's we have in academia a strange, structured, but also continuously open social life, because students and young career researcher, but also colleagues, you go to conferences and you always meet people who are unknown, strangers, but with whom it's very easy to come in contact because of shared interest. So it's on the social life, it's also really, really interesting.
So your latest book is Artificial Communication: How Algorithms Produce Social Intelligence. So can you tell us, how did you come to writing it?
The topic of artificial intelligence and how to deal from a sociological point of view with this new trend is something that I have been working on since decades. I said already in the 80s, the question was there. And it was at the time where the debate on, the artificial features of intelligence machine, or even what the debate was at the time, the idea they could have a consciousness, can become sentient beings and so on, was widespread and very interesting. So I started thinking about that at the time, but in a sense, testing some aspect of that. And I worked on other topics. I worked on fashion, I worked on memory and forgetting, I worked on probability calculus. But then in the last 10 years, I had the impression that what's going on now with the new algorithm, with the new development in digital media and digital techniques, was ripe to deal with this long topic from a different perspective. I have the impression that really we are at a turning point. And so I wanted to focus on that, and that's how the book came out.
So let's delve into some of the topics that you cover in your book, and we can start with the very basics. So can you explain, what is artificial intelligence?
Yeah, that is a basic question, but not an easy one, because it's something what people are talking about since computer began, since the end of the 50s. And the idea basically is the hope or the possibility, and sometimes the fear also, that it's possible to reproduce with machines, with computers, of course, and we're talking about these general purpose machines that began at the time, the feature of human intelligence. And yeah, then the way how people understand the idea of intelligence, the idea of artificial reproduction of intelligence, developed a lot in the last, in these 70 years or yeah, almost 70 years of research on that. But the idea basically remains that the machine should, could, in different ways, become intelligent. Abstract intelligence, emotional intelligence, practical intelligence, there's a lot of a different way to understand it.
So there are different ways that we can sort of apply this terminology to different aspects. Are they all correct?
They're all correct because what we saw also is that this debate about artificial intelligence in this long 50 years or so also focused on some aspect of another feature that was also not clear from the beginning, human intelligence. So thinking about the reproduction of intelligence in machines helped us to understand how many different kinds of intelligence exist. Well, computational intelligence, of course, but also emotional intelligence or ability to move in an environment. There are many, many different features that we, without really being clear about that, what we produce with machine and we attribute to the ability to be intelligent by human beings.
So what are some of the drawbacks of how we are currently thinking about the artificial intelligence?
Yeah, what struck me from the very beginning when people talk about it is that, of course, the idea of artificial intelligence is compelling and is fascinating, but if you think about as a metaphor, as a research program, is sort of strange because we want to reproduce with machines something of which we already know very little, because the idea from the very beginning was to reproduce not only the mind of human beings, but in a sense also, as now people talk about neural networks, the brain, so the working of the hardware that in human beings produces our intelligent features. And we still know very, very little about the brain. The brain is a fascinating mystery also for neurophysiologists. And what intelligence is, the debate about artificial intelligence here showed also that we also know very little about that, what intelligence is. So in a sense, it's a strange metaphor.
Hmm. So what does artificial communication mean?
I had the impression that to understand how machines are working now, because now this machine with the new kind of algorithm, with the labels are machine learning and big data, so since 15 years, more or less, machines are working a different way. They can do amazing things. They can communicate with us. They can write books. They can paint pictures. They can compose music and so on. But it seems to become more and more clear to me that they do that not because they finally have become able to be intelligent, but because the way of programming them has changed, and the machine, in a sense, the programmer themselves, don't try anymore to emulate human intelligence. In a sense, I would say this machine had become able to do these appeared intelligent things, not because they have become intelligent, but because they don't try to be intelligent anymore. And that's what brought me to propose to shift from the metaphor of intelligence to the metaphor of communication. The idea that these machines, these performances, are due to the fact that machines are beginning to learn to communicate with us. And that seems to me the new, really exciting phenomenon.
So concepts like algorithms seem to play quite a central role in all of this. So can you explain what exactly is an algorithm?
Yeah, it is. An algorithm is also a fashionable word now. But In a sense, what the way we are talking about algorithms since like 20 years is relatively imprecise, but so established that also I use this idea, because algorithms by themselves are something which is not new at all. The word, the idea, comes from the 17th century, and in general, well, in the beginning of computerization, one talked with, in the 50s, one talked about computers, but the computers work with algorithms. Algorithms are a sequence of steps that can be followed in a certain order and come to some result. In a sense, also a recipe about the menu, so it's also an algorithm. You have a series of steps to follow and you have a certain result. So by themselves, that's nothing mysterious. Well, computer always work with program that are series of steps, so there are algorithms, have also been algorithms, but since 15, 20 years, the idea of algorithm sort of shifted, because programs in programming and the data available produce new kind of algorithms that are really different from the previous one. That's why I think that the way we talk about algorithms now is that the new thing are not necessarily the algorithms, but the specific kind of machine learning algorithms. The fact the algorithm now seems to be able to learn by themselves, more and more autonomous, and that they use the so-called big data, a different kind of data that are, so in a sense, the raw material that algorithms are using.
And many of us heard these things that algorithms control our lives nowadays. And I was wondering, do we always know what goes into those algorithms, especially as you say with the neural networks? Do we always know what are the workings?
Well, no, that's the scary, challenging, but also fascinating aspect of the algorithms, because we don't know. Well, the point is, I myself, I'm not a programmer, so I cannot program myself. So lay people, but also many programs themselves, have to face a deep level of transparency in the machine, because these new algorithms, the advanced, it's called deep learning algorithms, are able to learn by themselves. They decide themselves what to learn. But in the most advanced one, they also decide by themselves how to learn and in which direction. And the designer themselves, in many cases, cannot understand how the machine is working. And that's, of course, is a huge challenge. But not only, you talk about what we know about how the machine works, and there's another level of transparency, because these machines very often are fed or they use this so-called big data, which are data which they find most cases on the web, and they are produced from many different heterogeneous sources, and the data themselves are not controlled, selected, cleaned, organized as the previous data that were used by probabilistic procedures. This new algorithm use different kind of sort of dirty, not controlled data, which are an additional element of complexity, but also of possible dangers. There's a lot of right debate about how data and algorithm itself can be biased. They can be produced unequal results and unfair results, which are partly corresponding to the intention of the programmer, partly basically uncontrollable.
So as we have these technologies contributing more and more to our everyday life, can you give us a few of your favorite examples?
Oh, that's really difficult, because there are some examples of things that everybody use in everyday life. Siri, the phone, Google, Google Maps, this also the sensor around that we are not even aware. But also fascinating are the ways in which technologies work with algorithms, with this controlling procedure, of which we are not even aware of. But the favorite ones, we sociologists have difficulty in choosing what's the favorite, the less favorite, because, all these phenomena for us are first of all, interesting. Even the negative ones, in a sense, are interesting. And so.
So what would be your favorite positive ones then? And then we can go to negative.
Positive is also possibly the negative one. I'm fascinating. I'm a generation that still remembers a world where we are not connected communicatively with other people all the time. And that's amazing, interesting, and of course, terribly scary.
This is also a feed into this concept of uncanny valley with the sometimes when we don't really understand what's happening or it strikes slightly too close home.
Yeah. That's an interesting phenomenon. But the way the concept is used or the way I know it is, especially on robots or also it came with robots, but also in general with algorithms, that we are trying since decades to build machines or procedures that are as possible closer to our behavior. But when they do it, we are terribly scared or we don't feel at ease. For example, the robots, the people building them are, of course, very clever and very experienced. If the robot is too similar to human beings, people don't feel at ease. And says that's why they make the strange features with the strange eyes and strange faces that actually are not really similar to ourselves. Or even if you find that a program is producing itself, communication, contents, is able to talk with us, is fascinating. You know, the idea that people can also get in love with the digital systems on, that should be the goal of these technologies that are presented. But when we face it, the feeling is really not comfortable.
Oh, yes, for sure. And this last thing that you mentioned, it's really disorienting in some way when you understand that it's not a living thing talking to you, you know, but algorithm.
Yeah, of course. But that's where the idea of artificial communication comes in, because I think that a lot of this discomfort that we have and worries and a lot of the debates about the so-called scared and debated singularity, the idea that the machine may take control and, be more intelligent than human beings as a competition. At the moment, the machine becomes more intelligent than human being, something terrible is expected to happen. I think it's simply misguided in many cases. I don't think that the machines are good in some way or that there are no worries, but the competition between human beings and machine is not what worries me first, because I think the machines are not intelligent, don't want to be intelligent. So that's not a real problem. What we are producing is a network that, first of all, makes our communicative abilities much more powerful.
So all of these technologies, of course, they're not living as we understand cognitively, but they are really contributing to the organization of our knowledge. So can you tell us what kind of ways we sort of use to organize it?
Yeah. Maybe I start from a relatively simple example that is common in the debate. Take, for example, this the new translator programs. Like a Deep Translator, Google Translator, so on. They are algorithms, and they are now, I remember a couple of decades ago, there already were some forms of automatic translation, which was sort of useful, but ridiculous. It made so many mistakes, the text were not useful, and so on. And now some of these products produce excellent text. Of course, you correct some word or another, and sometimes they are funny, misunderstanding, but in most cases, the result is really extraordinarily good. And there is one of the points where I see the difference, because if you talk with the programmers, it becomes clear that they change the attitude from reproducing intelligence to producing communication. until 20 years ago, they tried to teach the machine the rules of the language as a human being would learn it, that the rules of the grammar of the language, to put a dictionary of a possible broader dictionary of the words. So the idea that the more the machine was able to do what we do when we translate, the better it would work. And now what they are doing with these machine learning algorithms is we have translator programs which have been produced by programmers, for example, a program translating from English to Chinese, for example. The programmers don't know Chinese, and the machine itself doesn't know Chinese at all. It doesn't know English. The machine doesn't understand the text, but just finds in the huge amount of data that is available on the web, patterns, examples that allow to translate a text from a language to the other without understanding what it means, without understanding the rules, but producing a very useful product. And that's what I understand, the example I understand with the shift from intelligence to communicative capability.
So basically, it's not really necessary then to have this deep understanding of something in terms of algorithmic translation, as you say, for the program to be able to perform well, isn't it?
That's what I mean. I think it seems that in many cases, and some programs which are working, or most of the programs working with machine learning, say the machine doesn't have to understand. It's actually too heavy a burden. Claiming that the machine should understand what the text it produces, the text it works with, sort of make it much too complex without real advantages. The machine has to find patterns, correlations, structures that allow to perform as if it understood the text. But understanding by itself is not required.
So if we touch on the other very tangible example, like image search, for example, online, or image recognition. So how do algorithms feed into that?
Oh, that would be also another example. If you see how this program works, for example, the famous image of a cat, if we were to recognize the images of animals like cats, we have some features that we find, like the ears or the whiskers, I'd call it, or something. And we have a sort of an idea of a cat, which we try to find in the different realization, bigger, smaller, gray, white, and so on. The algorithm does something completely different. It calculates aspects which are completely not understandable for us, like regularity in distance between some features. So it finds out something which for us in many cases is completely not understandable. But the result is it's an amazing ability to recognize images not only of cats, of animals, but as we know, of human faces. And so all this image recognition, very powerful programs.
Yeah, and that's a great transition to my next question, is actually connecting now our human side to all of this. So how do human rights play into this?
Well, human rights are one aspect. Human ability are, if I may, is a previous one that we have to consider, because the shift from intelligence to communication doesn't mean that human intelligence becomes irrelevant or that human beings are not needed in producing new forms of information. Because that's where this big data and the data that the algorithm finds on the web come in. Because the algorithms became able to learn more and more and to work in this amazing, powerful way only at the time when they could access the data that we human beings produce on the web, after the so-called Web 2.0, the participatory web. Then everybody, each of us, produce a lot of data with our behavior every day on the web or otherwise, with GPS or moving streets where there are sensors recording our behavior, or surfing the web, or participation in social media, and so on. And these are the materials which are inherently intelligent, because we produce them with our intelligence, with our ability to move in the world. And these are the material that the machine use in order to produce something that allowed them to behave as if they were intelligent. So without the contribution of human beings, machine would not be able to communicate in this intelligent way.
So in a way, they actually need us as well.
Of course, they need us, absolutely. We need the machine, but in a sense, what the machine gives to us is a re-elaborated version of the intelligence that we, human beings, put into the system.
So once our information is out there, that's a really sort of a pertinent sentiment going around, it's really difficult to get it back, or it's even impossible. So what about the right to be forgotten, basically, on the internet?
Yeah, that's it was a big debate in the 2014, where in Europe, the European Parliament, the Court of Justice, decided that we have a regulation to protect the right of individuals to be forgotten. But it's another of these amazing shifts, because for millennia, for us human beings, the big problem has always been to remember, to be able to remember, to keep the information, because, you know, our intelligence, in a sense, our mind, the difficult thing is to remember, not to forget. If you do nothing, naturally we forget. And we have all these techniques, like, you know, mnemonic techniques, but also books, in a sense, are all tools that help us not to lose information, to keep it, to be able to remember. And now with the web, the entire frame seems to be upside down, because what is comes by itself without any effort, without any work from our side, is that things are remembered, not that they are forgotten. We have to decide explicitly if you want to erase something, which means forget. For example, think about your emails. Usually one keeps everything. There's no reason to erase things. So normally everything is remembered, and it requires decision and work in order to have something forgotten, which changes completely the attitude. That's why the regulation of the right to be forgotten became needed, because normally the information are not lost. They are there, and they are there not only as the right, the legal frame requires, of some criminal acts and so on that should be maybe forgotten, but everything is there of everyone since we are moving on the web. So what a person in his childhood or his teenager years does on the web remains there if you don't have some regulation, and can sort of change, limit, burden our life after decades.
Yes, for sure. And like you say, children, but also other individuals who might be in a vulnerable position. So it's really difficult to know what exactly you can put out there.
Yeah, and in a sense, everybody is in a vulnerable position, because we don't know in the present what we want in the future. So it's always difficult to see. We do something which is completely harmless now, and it can become a vulnerability or an aspect that we don't know about in 5 months, 5 years, 50 years.
And this concept of artificial communication, actually, it helps me think about it in a slightly different way as well, rather than saying general artificial intelligence.
Yeah, I agree. I think it can help. Also because I think it can help to find a solution for this mystery, because it's not clear how you can block forgetting, because or increase forgetting, in a sense, because we have a lot of techniques for increasing remembering, but if you try to increase forgetting, you immediately see that's a paradox, because to forget something, you have to focus your attention on that and then cancel it, which is sort of paradoxical. It's very, very difficult to have a technique for forgetting. But if you refer to communication, the solution seems to be a little more plausible, because there are techniques in communication to reinforce forgetting that don't work in the same way. The algorithm works in a different way. The algorithm can do something which is actually an equivalent of forgetting, because they can produce so many data, so many noise and contradictory or diverse information, that at the end, it's so difficult to find the information that the people doesn't want to have remembered. And so practically, there is an equivalent of forgetting.
So what's in store for the future of artificial communication?
The question is how this shift from intelligence to communication can be realized. But I have the impression that in many cases, to understand what's going on, my experience is if you try to think about not reproduction of intelligence, but something that in a complex way affects the way we communicate with each other or the information that can circulate among us, even if not produced by a human being, but they are produced through a different procedures, a technical procedure, I think many questions become more understandable. For example, one aspect that I find fascinating also how predictions become more and more relevant. Because in many cases, if you have something that you cannot, unfortunately, you cannot understand, you cannot use it to explain what's going on, but you can still use to predict if the information is reliable. And many projects on the web now are shifting towards a more and more important role of prediction.
Yes, predictions play a huge role, don't they, in our society in general, from the weather to stock markets. So do you see that algorithms are going to play basically the main role in these areas?
Well, there's people are talking about a form of algorithmic prediction, which is actually different from the forms of prediction we are used to. Because when we think about prediction, we usually think about probabilistic procedure. We get the data and use this data to face the uncertainty of the future. So we don't know what will happen, but we know, for example, think about getting ill, or a possible disaster, or possible positive stock market behaviors. And we have an idea that we are not sure, but we know that it's going to happen in 70% of the cases, or 30%, and so on. And that's how, in a sense, we prepared for the future, our form of dealing with prediction. Algorithms work in a completely different way. And they don't have probabilities. They claim to tell you not what will happen for an average of the persons or for an average of the development. They claim to give you, to find out a pattern and tell you what will happen, for example, to a singular person. Not how many people will get sick, but if a particular person me or my cousin or any of you can become sick in 5 years of what? And that's a completely different way of dealing with uncertainty of the future.
And it's actually a bit more intuitive way for a human as well, because we're really bad with dealing with uncertainty.
Yeah, sure. But it's intuitive, it's attractive, but of course remains uncertain from another point of view. And even if this prediction were really reliable, and we're not ever sure about that, the question is, how can we combine this individualized prediction in a social structure? For example, think about medicine. Our medical systems is prepared not to deal with my particular idiosyncratic health development, but the idea is to offer drugs and treatment that work for everyone. But since each of us is different, how can you have a health system that takes care of all this completely idiosyncratic different health developments?
So now thinking about the bigger picture, so why should we be thinking about these topics and researching all of these questions, and how will it benefit our society?
Well, I think we have no choice. I'm biased on that, I'm a sociologist. There's something which is going on, and we have to try. And we have a lot of benefits. We see it already now. One of the fields that we're talking about, medical fields, we have procedures that are really enormous developments, but of course have a lot of possible challenges and risks and threats and so on. And I would say the algorithms that new developers are good, artificial communication is good or bad, I don't know, but it's something different. And what I want to do is try to understand what's going on and try to prepare, to be prepared to some possible, for we talked about bias, inequalities, reproduction of unfair behaviors. That's what we have to be prepared for. We have to prepare for something for which our present legislation or prior society, our political system are not prepared. And then we have positive aspect and some also negative one, but we have to try to understand what in the new developments are different from the structure we already have.
So are you optimistic then that we will be able to sort of manage all of these technologies for the good of everybody?
That's a really difficult question. Because, well, something which I'm worried is think about the political system, and that's the development now towards more and more, people talk about fake news and populism and polarization and so on. There's something which is clearly connected with the role of algorithms. Our communication, the social media, and the way how things are produced have a different shape from what are at the base of our modern democratic society. And it's not easy to find a way to preserve the warranties of our, live together in such different conditions. I wouldn't say that's impossible, but it will be difficult.
Yeah, for sure. And it's so important to be raising these questions and having these discussions as well, isn't it?
Sure. And there's a lot going on, as I said. A lot of interesting development. And what should be a little, give me something to think, that the developers are very much often guided by the technology, because the programmers and the people in technology are developing these systems which are really running and running, become more and more able to do things, and we just follow that. The theoretical reflection on this new development is sort of lagging behind. And I have the impression we need more theoretical reflection on the technologies.
And what discoveries during your writing process and your research for your book, Artificial Communication, surprised you the most?
Well, but it's sort of a basic, easy thing, but what surprised me most is how the idea of the centrality of human beings is still there. That how the debate on the new development is nevertheless, even if the machines are getting more and more powerful able to do things, that the idea still remains how we are competing with them, what the role of human beings, even in many cases not the central one. For example, in the field of artificial intelligence, something which keeps coming up again and again is something like the Turing test. The idea, a test was proposed by Alan Turing 100 years ago, that is meant to test whether a machine is intelligent by checking if a user of the machine understands, is aware to be interacting with the machine and not with the human being. If the user doesn't realize that they're talking with the machine is meant to be intelligent, which is a very, very strange idea, because what it measures is, of course, not the intelligence of the machine, but on the term of what they're saying, the ability of the machine to communicate with us. And why should we be particularly interested in that? Well, everybody is now communicating with bots every day. People talk with Siri, or people without even knowing it. People playing video games online or booking tickets and so on. We interact every day, many, many times with bots, and we don't well, we don't notice it. The machine passed the Turing test many times every day, and in many cases, we don't even care. But still, the idea that knowing if a human being is there is meant to be something relevant, so detached from the reality of what's going on.
Do you ever get fearful that artificial intelligence is going to be, to get so intelligent that they're going to rise against the humanity?
No, I don't. I'm worried that many things can go wrong. I would say it's going to be, well, in any case, I'm not optimistic by itself. But the idea that the machine become more intelligent than us doesn't worry me at all, because they are not intelligent.
Oh, that's good to know. So do we have the representation of AI in our popular culture a little bit off then? Or maybe do you have your favorite AI from the film?
Well, no, not really. That's the film. Well, there are some very clever things that are, of course, popular. Think about She or Her. What was it? The I don't know how to translate in the original title. With the, what was this? Joaquin Phoenix interacting with the operating system, which of course the fascinating voice of Scarlett Johansson. It was clever as an idea, but I don't think it's realistic. So for instance, it's entertaining, but it doesn't seem to me to really. Well, I think that the imagination we have about the about artificial intelligence is in many cases disconnected to what's really going on in the field.
Well, I'm glad that we won't have the uprising of machines anytime soon, at least.
Yes. Not in the form we expect, in a sense. But, you know, the development in this field almost regularly disappoint expectations, and the real powerful or important developments were often unexpected things, but nobody predicted the email or even the social media were not predicted in this form. We expect something to happen, and then, luckily or not, often the technological development takes another way.
Well, this has been a truly fascinating discussion. So can you tell us what are you currently working on and what will be your next project?
You might have perceived a little. I'm very fascinated in prediction. And now I'm leading a five-year-long project financed by the European Research Council with the name The Future of Prediction, where we try to observe how the forms of prediction are changing when algorithms are used. And the subtitle is The Social Consequences of Algorithmic Forecast in Insurance, Medicine, and Policing. That's a much more empirical, concrete project where we want to explore how the new form of algorithm prediction impact in field of our society, where still rely pretty much on probabilistic forms of prediction. Think about insurance or, well, how precision medicine is a different form of prediction.
Oh, that sounds great.
We are enjoying it very much. And the field where at the moment there are the most surprising developments is the one which seems less fascinating. Well, policing, of course, you know, predictive policing, where algorithms claim to predict who was committing a crime before we commit it, is of course fascinating. But insurance seems to a sort of dry field, not a really adventurous one, but very amazing developments going on already there. For example, the idea that you can have individualized risk prediction, and the algorithm tells you who is going to have a car crash or get sick and so on in advance. And for the insurance, seems like a great opportunity, until the people insured realize that if that were possible, insurance would break down, would not be possible anymore, because the mechanism of insurance relies on the fact that we don't know precisely who will get sick, or will have a car crash. Therefore, everybody is available to pay a little insurance fee that in many cases paid for nothing, but protects everyone. The resource of this technologies is shared in uncertainty. The idea that Nobody knows the future, and the other also don't know it. And that's why we deal with that together. And individualized prediction, like the one the algorithm can provide, would make the system completely impossible.
Harvesting the power of algorithm for good.
Yeah, in a sense, yes.
And what would be the best way for our listeners to find more information about your work and also your book?
Yeah, my book will be released, or it's already now. The official release date is May 24th by MIT Press with the title Artificial Communication. And yeah, of course, it can be found on the web or can be found in the old-fashioned bookstores, which are also a nice place to visit to have inspiration for other interesting things to read.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much. It was a really, really interesting conversation.